The group of families living in a cluster of houses on Smith Drive had been friends. Their kids played together. Parents saw each other at the school bus stop in the mornings and socialized in the evenings. But in early August of 2012, a dispute ignited between the families. It began when a birthday gift left on a porch went missing. When one family realized they had never received it, they suspected one of the kids who lived down the street had snatched it. That suspicion turned into an accusation. The accusation prompted a call to the police, and that sparked a feud that led to the vulgar taunting of a preteen girl, nonstop shouting, petty complaints, violent threats, and attempts by both sides to have the judicial system intervene. Then things turned deadly. Early in the hours of September 3rd, 2012, less than a month since the dispute had begun, two men who had been laughing at a party minutes before lay dead in front of their homes, and a third man lay bleeding, shot 11 times. The gunman stood in front of his home and waited for police to come for him while his wife and children slept inside his house.
He was a vigilante. He was going to take the law into his own hands, and he was going to dispense the justice that he thought was appropriate to these people that he considered to be prey.
William Woodward, who goes by Billy, was charged with capital murder for the shooting deaths of two of his neighbors and attempted murder for the injury of a third man who survived the attack. He was set to sign paperwork the next day to buy a new house and move away from the neighbors he and his family said terrorized them daily for nearly a month. How did things go so wrong between neighbors who had once been friends? How did the taunting, harassment, and threats start? And how did it get so out of hand? Did Billy's past military service, his PTSD, or his brain injury lead him to resort to violence sooner than he would have otherwise? Was the group of neighbors on one side of the street planning an attack, or were they just hurling empty threats at him for the fun of it? Or is this the case of Billy Woodward taking the law into his own hands? This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 113. In last week's episode, I talked about Caldrea, a consciously crafted home and body care brand that combines thoughtful ingredients with delectable scents. Well, did you know that they also have some awesome air care products that transform your home with your favorite fragrances? Air care products like linen and room spray and candles can help you instantly turn your home into somewhere you want to be. There's a perfect fragrance for every mood and every room. The other day, I had my sea salt neroli candle lit in our kitchen, and my husband walked in and commented at how much he liked the smell of it. And Caldrea's customers have been leaving amazing reviews on their website. One customer called the linen and room spray heaven in a bottle and said that guests were asking them about the scent. Another customer also loved the sea salt neroli candle, saying, "It's not overpowering, just that lovely fragrance throughout." So like I said, I have the sea salt neroli candle that I use in our kitchen, and then I like to use the pear blossom agave spray in the living room. That one gives off a bright and crisp scent of fresh pear blossom, ripe citrus, and succulent melon, perfect for the summertime. Now, you can get free shipping on orders of $50 or more when you buy online at caldrea.com. That's caldrea.com. Visit Caldrea.com and find your signature scent. Did you know that 75% of us are walking around everyday life chronically dehydrated? We are suffering, needlessly, from frequent headaches, energy slumps, and poor focus. I am definitely in that 75%. I don't drink nearly as much water as I should, and as I'm talking, I actually have a headache right now. Well, now there's Hydrant. Hydrant created flavored electrolyte packets that actually taste good and are refreshing. You just mix it directly into your water to efficiently and effectively hydrate your body. Each rapid hydration mix has the four essential electrolytes your body needs: sodium, potassium, magnesium, and zinc. This precise blend of electrolytes found in their mix helps your body hydrate quickly and then stay hydrated all day. And Hydrin is backed by research. The formula was developed by an Oxford scientist to provide perfectly balanced, efficient hydration. Best of all, there's no synthetic colors, stevia, or artificial sweeteners. The formula is vegan, and you can choose between 3 different flavors or a variety pack. I've tried the blood orange and lime so far, and both are surprisingly tasty, like I just infused my water with actual fruit. Hydrant starts at just $1 a packet for a 30-day supply. And bonus, you save even more with a monthly subscription. And for 25% off your first order, go to drinkhydrant.com/court or enter promo code court at checkout. That's drinkhydrant.com/court and enter promo code court for 25% off your first order. drinkhydrant.com/court and enter promo code court. Titusville, Florida is a small coastal town in central Florida, minutes from Kennedy Space Center. The Woodwards had lived on Smith Drive since 1998, occupying one of the small single-family homes on the street. Gary Hembry lived one house down from the Woodwards, across a small side street, with his daughter. In 2012, he started dating Kim Silsbury. After dating her for a few months, she moved in with him, bringing her twin daughters with her to live in the home. The 2-bedroom, 1-bathroom house got even more crowded when an old friend of Gary's, Roger Pecor, moved in. Roger was between jobs and needed a place to stay. He moved in along with his girlfriend, Jessica Nobles. They also had recently gotten a new neighbor on the street. Tim Blake moved into a house next door to where Gary and Roger lived that spring, along with his wife, Carrie, and their 2 children, who were 7 and 12 at the time. The Blakes quickly became friendly with their neighbors. At one point, Billy Woodward had even paid the Blakes rent when money was tight. But the neighbors turned against each other late that summer, and things escalated quickly. Ava Woodward turned 12 years old in August of 2012, and was about to start the 7th grade. Her mother's friend brought by a birthday gift and treats for her inside a small cooler. The Woodwards weren't home, so she set them on the front porch. The next day, she called Barbara Woodward and asked if they had gotten the gift. They hadn't seen it at all. Barbara immediately suspected the girl who lived across the street at the Hembry house, who she had seen outside the day before.
I knew right away that it had to be someone in that household.
Why is that?
One of the children was frequently stealing things from our property and others' property around the neighborhood. The day before that, I had seen three of the children trying to break in the house across the street.
Billy called police to report the theft and had a police officer with him when he went across the street to question Gary. It was that call that set off a series of confrontations that were seemingly nonstop over the next several weeks. The argument wasn't just between Billy and Gary. Gary's housemates, Kim, Roger, and Jessica, were pulled into the fight. Tim and Carrie Blake, the new neighbors who live next door, were also drawn in. They couldn't believe that Billy would accuse a child of stealing and take it to police. Both houses sided against the Woodwards. After the report about the missing gift, Gary Hembry walked towards the Woodward home and took photos of the chickens that they were raising in their backyard. He made a report to the city's code enforcement office, which regulates livestock inside city limits, and the chickens were removed. For Billy, these weren't just any chickens. In a video of Billy's police interview, played at trial, Billy explained that caring for the animals was like therapy for him.
It just broke my heart because we hand raised every one of them. And they were my peace and serenity.
After the chickens were taken away by city workers, Billy challenged Gary to come fight him in the street. Billy said he lifted his shirt up above his waistband to prove he had no weapons, something another neighbor not involved in the dispute confirmed. But the group of neighbors who cited against him claimed he showed them a gun that day. Either way, Gary wouldn't come into the street and told Billy to come over to his yard. Billy wouldn't cross over onto Gary's property, so instead, they screamed at each other until police were called. Back out on Smith Drive, police told the neighbors to go inside and leave each other alone. Things quieted down, at least for a little while. But as the neighbors tell it, the quiet would not last long. Gary, Roger, Tim, and their wives and girlfriends, Jessica, Kim, and Carrie, began screaming insults at the Woodward house daily. Sometimes they'd get their kids involved, as witnesses reported seeing the women whispering into the children's ears just before the children threw insults at them. The group of neighbors claimed that Billy Woodward dished out insults as fast as he received them, but whether that's true isn't clear. That's because soon, these daily arguments were all on tape. Billy installed a surveillance camera outside. It faced out to the carport, directly pointed at Gary Hembree's house. The video it captured would document the last month of Gary's life. Hours of footage from the camera would later be played at Billy Woodward's trial. As evidenced in the camera footage, the screams were sometimes nothing but strings of profanity or insults. The neighbors called Billy a plastic G.I. Joe and mocked his army service and called his wife and daughter names. By some of the other neighbors' accounts, they started hearing the shouts occasionally, usually just when Billy went outside or one of his family members walked by. Soon, they were every day, sometimes going on for hours at a time, even as the family cowered inside their home. Neighbors, as well as police who reviewed security footage from the Woodward home, said that it did not appear that the Woodwards were ever the ones to instigate the shouting. When the screaming began, it had been mostly insults. Then it turned into threats. Two of the women, Carrie and Kim, threatened to hire someone to rape and sodomize Billy's daughter, 12-year-old Ava, repeatedly, a threat so vile it even shocked some people within the group. They said they would burn down the Woodward's house. Barbara Woodward said her daughter would get off the bus some days to find neighbors sitting out in their yards, waiting for her with a string of shouts. The shouts came from different people in the houses, including the women and children.
I can still hear their voices screaming at me in the street. And he said, yeah, that's what we're going to do. She said she would pay people if she had to. And Billy kept saying, leave my daughter alone.
Barbara noticed their 4-year-old son acting nervous and agitated. Ava stayed inside the house in fear of what might happen. Barbara said she was also terrified, especially when the group told her that they had bought a gun and she saw a photo posted on Facebook showing Roger posing with a firearm.
Like, we have a gun now, and they would make a finger gesture of a gun and point it at us. We have a gun now. We can do whatever we want.
A few weeks into the dispute, the Woodwards decided to file a claim against their neighbors for harassment and asked the court for an injunction to keep their neighbors away from them. In response, Gary Hembree and Tim Blake filed a similar motion against Billy Woodward. In a joint hearing on August 29th, Judge John Moxley listened to both sides detail their versions of the dispute.
It was tense. It was emotional. Both Gary and Mr. Woodward were visibly upset, tears. Their voices were shaken. They were very upset.
The Woodwards had subpoenaed some of the Titusville police officers who had been called out to the neighborhood in response to the screaming and arguments between the neighbors. They also asked other neighbors on the street to come to the hearing to testify about the harassment. But the judge didn't call on all the witnesses. After hearing about the back and forth of the neighbors' disputes, he instead told everyone to go home and play nice. Billy couldn't believe his attempt at justice had failed so miserably.
And Judge Moxley had the nerve to sit and listen to each and every one of their fucking lies and say, yes, I believe you had a gun, Mr. Woodward. And when I tried to say perjury, mm-hmm. when they were perjuring themselves, he said, Mr. Woodward, if you don't shut your mouth, I will make these subpoenas, injunctions stick. He wouldn't even give the police officers a chance to speak.
The group wasn't out of the courthouse parking lot before things got violent. As Billy Woodward left the courthouse, he said he saw Gary taking photos of him, which made him enraged. He approached Gary and Kim as they were getting into their car.
He hadn't crossed the street yet. He was still on the sidewalk, on the courthouse sidewalk side. And he pointed at myself and Gary and said, are you prepared to die?
Billy grabbed Gary's head and pushed his thumbs into the other man's eye sockets. Kim tried to pull the two apart, burning Billy with a lit cigarette in her hand. The fight didn't dissipate until someone in the parking lot sprayed pepper spray over the entire group. Billy was arrested after the parking lot assault. One of the other neighbors on the street, Jeffrey Crow, had shown up to testify during the hearing for the joint injunction. He wasn't called on to speak, but just showing up had made him a new target for the group of rowdy neighbors. Crow said the problems between his neighbors had started off small, but quickly grew to hours and hours of harassment. It got much worse after the court hearing.
They would get children to call Barbara a bitch when she walked her dog. And that basically whisper in their ears, and you know that's where it came from, because it was whisper, then you hear these kids yell that. They had threatened to kill Billy on a couple occasions and kill his children and his family. And that bothered us quite a bit.
And when you say they, who was that?
Basically, it's like a gang mentality. It could be any of them. Most of the time, it was like Roger, Carey, Gary.
Although in the beginning, the yelling was directed at only the Woodwards, that changed.
It was mostly after we went down to get a restraining order, and Gary and Bruce and the whole gang realized that we were there to testify against them. And from that point on, it was pretty much on with them. If we walked out in the yard, we were the subject of their attack verbally, and it wouldn't end unless we really went back inside. My wife and my daughter were very fearful of this group, and we wanted to know what was going on with them at all times. We didn't want to get caught off guard. We were as scared as Billy and their family was, and quite a few of the neighbors were too. And we wanted to keep aware of the situation so that if it did turn against us, that we were, you know, ready to run inside or call the police.
And you said you were scared. Were there any threats made against you or your family?
2 to 3 times they had threatened to kill us, threatened to kill my daughter. Threatened to kill my wife and threatened to kill myself.
The Crows called the police several times, but as Crow saw it, the police didn't offer them any solutions.
Well, we called the police, and the police came out to our house, took our statement, and they told us there was nothing they could do. And I said, officer, I thought if someone had threatened to kill your life, your family, your child, that you could do something, talk to them, put a restraining order, maybe even arrest them. And we were told it was freedom of speech. And I said, you're kidding me. I said, they threatened to kill my daughter. And they said, there's nothing we can do. We did not hear it. And in this country, it's freedom of speech. And it still doesn't sound right to me, but they walked off.
Without help from law enforcement, the situation grew worse. Crow said he hated going home to the nightly screaming and threats. However, he considered the crew of shouting neighbors capable of the violence they yelled about. He felt he had to be home with his wife and child in case the group got serious about their threats.
And what happened every night went from being a little bit scary to becoming terrifying because it had doubled, tripled the amount of vulgarities, the threats, the intensity of the shouting.
And as time went on, did that just get worse?
Oh, yes. And it accumulated every day.
And how did that affect you and your family?
Well, it's terrifying. I work in Melbourne, so I'm about an hour away from work. And I did not want to go home at nighttime because every time I got home, which was about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, just several hours after I went to bed, they were still outside there screaming. But at the same time, I knew that my wife and my daughter were terrified of them. And I wanted to get home for their safety as soon as I could because I really didn't know what kind of frame of mind they were going to be in that day. And I did not want to leave my family unprotected.
Billy's father, William Woodward Sr., is a retired Titusville police officer who lived just a few minutes away. As the situation on Smith Drive grew more intense, he began showing up at his son's house when Billy needed to go somewhere so that he could stand by as his son went outside so he could make sure things didn't get worse. The group of neighbors began to threaten him as well.
And they were kind of taunting and yelling, like, come on over here and let's see what we got, and things like that. And I was close enough to hear that. And at one point, Roger Picor came across the yard to the area right around the sidewalk and yelled, I need to cave that old man's head in. I just think I'll cave it in.
William said his son grew distraught after the court failed to address the concerns.
I felt after the injunctions were disallowed, I felt like we were now at the mercy of the street, that we couldn't count on the system to help us anymore. We'd done everything legal we could. And now we have to go back home and play nice. And it started right after that again.
We'll be right back after this quick break from today's sponsors. From lattes to dog treats, CBD is popping up in everything. But it can be confusing, so complicated. Where do you start? How can you tell what's good and what's not? And even more importantly, who can you trust? Enter SunSoil CBD. With SunSoil, you know what's in every bottle and exactly where it comes from. There's no second guessing because they only use ingredients you can understand and trust. Most of their products have just two: organic hemp and organic coconut oil. Transparency and quality control are what sets SunSoil apart from the rest. They farm all their own hemp in the Green Mountains of Vermont and extract CBD themselves, testing for quality and purity every step of the way. They never use pesticides, herbicides, or GMOs. Because SunSoil does everything in-house and keeps their products simple, they can offer the highest quality CBD at unbeatable prices. In fact, SunSoil products are half the price of other ingestible CBD brands. Every SunSoil product is USDA organic, including their oil drops, soft gels, capsules, and coconut oil. SunSoil removes all the guesswork by making pure and simple CBD products at an unbeatable price. Get 30% off your first order by going to sunsoil.com/junkie. That's sunsoil.com/junkie for 30% off your first order. We've got an exciting podcast to share today. It's Copycat Killers from Reels and Podcast One. Every week, Copycat Killers goes behind the headlines of real-life murder cases, which copy memorable slayings seen in Hollywood movies. Stay tuned to the end of this episode for a great clip from Copycat Killers. Then be sure to subscribe on Spotify, Podcast One, Apple Podcasts, and many other podcast listening apps so you don't miss an episode. It was the Sunday night before the Labor Day holiday, 4 days since the court hearing. A group of Smith Drive neighbors on one side of the street were having a party. They were grilling, drinking beer, blaring music, and as usual, shouting at their neighbor. The party included the usual group of people who lived in the houses: Gary and Kim and their children, Roger and his girlfriend Jessica, and Tim and Carrie next door, along with their 7-year-old and 12-year-old, and a few other kids from the neighborhood. Down the street, Billy and Barbara Woodward had returned from eating dinner at a restaurant and were inside with their two children. Barbara had suggested spending the night at Billy's parents' house in order to avoid the ruckus next door, but the couple ended up staying in their own home that night. The next morning, they had plans to sign paperwork to finalize purchasing another house. Their offer had been accepted, and they planned to meet their real estate agent the next day.
we went to a local realtor and said, we're in a situation. We need to find a new house right now. And he worked with us, told us, you know, we told him what we could afford, and he found us a wonderful, wonderful house. And we were so happy to put a bid on it, and they accepted it. And we were just really encouraged that we would be able to move soon and get out.
That night, Barbara testified that her husband seemed calm. Billy, however, later told police that his mind was racing. Throughout the night, especially after he put his 4-year-old son to bed, he monitored what was going on down the street. Barbara heard the neighbors shouting, and as usual, it made her nervous. She took a pill prescribed to her for anxiety to help her fall asleep and went to bed. Around 9 p.m., Tim Blake stumbled into the street, singing his own version of a Charlie Daniels song, but with the lyrics changed to violent threats. Down the street, the group grew larger. Roger's teenage son, Justin, came over with a friend. They were eating, drinking alcohol, and still playing music. Close to 11 p.m., Billy heard a series of bangs that he thought were shots from a .22 pistol from across the street. Billy took a sedative and tried to relax. On the security footage from the Woodwards' home, shown in its entirety at trial, the music and loud talking is audible, although for the majority of the night, the only thing visible on the footage is Billy's white truck parked in a carport in the shadow of the houses down the street. At one point that night, a group of people approach Billy's security cameras and pull their pants down, mooning the camera. The partygoers then lit a large palm branch on fire in the street. While this happened, people in the group chanted, "Burn, baby, burn," and then some racially charged shouts, such as KKK and white power. It's not clear if those shouts were directed at anyone specifically, since the Woodwards, like their neighbors, were all white. Billy saw the flames from his kitchen window. He said he couldn't stand to stay inside any longer. He had to know what they were doing, if they were planning something. Were they about to light his house on fire? About 20 minutes after the fire, a shadowy figure crawled on his stomach across the driveway, a gun tucked by his side. Moments went by. An uproar of laughter came from the party across the street. Justin Pecor and his father, Roger, wrestled near the carport of the Hembry home. Shouting continued sporadically. The words were difficult to hear in the video footage shown at trial, but police detectives confirmed that when they listened, they heard the words, "Come on, let's get him. Let's end this." And those are the words that Billy said made him fear for his life and jump into action. Justin, who was 17 years old at the time, was one of the first to see Billy approach out of the darkness.
I'd say right about there is whenever I was like, oh shit. And that's when my dad turned around and it was too late at that point.
Then the gunfire started. Billy then walked next door to Tim Blake's house.
I walked in, got to figure out, I come outside and made it all the way to my truck. And I heard the first shot and I looked up, see what, then I heard two more and I started feeling them. And then that's when Billy was just standing there shooting me.
Billy then walked back to the Hembry house, where Justin hid behind a car a few feet away from where his father lay injured.
I dove behind Kim's car first, and that's when I could see William walking up. As I was laying down, I could see his feet and hear him coming. When he was coming towards the car, that's when I hopped up and I put my hands up and was like, "Don't shoot me, I didn't do anything." And he walked up to me, pointed the gun at me still, but never shot. And then that's when he didn't do nothing. He walked back towards my dad. And then when he started to walk away is when I took off.
Justin ran back inside the Hembry house through a back door, just as Gary and Kim headed out the door leading to the carport. Billy had a clear shot and fired his gun, shooting Gary in his chest. Billy then saw his first victim, Roger, writhing in pain in the driveway. He shot Roger again, this time in his head. Out of bullets, he walked back towards his house. Seconds later, red and blue lights from patrol cars illuminated the street, and the sound of more sirens approaching grew louder. As the police cars rolled up, those inside the house came outside to see what happened. In the last moments before the security footage shown at trial shut off, Billy's words to a police officer were audible.
The war is over, sir.
The war is over, sir. Titusville Police Corporal Sean Anderson turned onto Smith Drive and found Billy standing in the road in front of his home, with his hands up and tucked behind his head. His empty gun was by his side. At trial, Anderson played a recording he made during Billy's first statement at the scene.
What happened with the shooting here? What was going on with that?
Well, sir, I was tired of living in fear of my family.
And what were you in fear of?
My life and their lives also.
What happened this evening?
A snap, sir.
A snap? Okay, what happened when you snapped? Did you shoot anybody?
Yes, sir, I've got three individuals.
He said he was tired of living in fear and that he snapped. When asked if he shot anybody, he said yes, three individuals. When Billy was arrested, he gave another statement to Titusville Police Detective Sarah Kane Watson, the video of which was played at trial. Throughout his interview, he spoke matter-of-factly about the attack on his neighbors, as if it had been a military mission.
I crossed my sidewalk on my hands and knees. As soon as I got to the grass, I instantly got as low as a snake.
Okay.
And I remember crawling inches at a time and was listening to him taunting and yelling across the street. When I got to his property, I snuck along the perimeter of his house until I got to the corner of his house. When I got to the corner of the house is when I charged. Or I know as a soldier that when you engage your enemy, you have to have the element of surprise.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have ferocity and speed and accuracy when you rush your enemy. I walked across the street. I did not engage any children. I did not engage any women. You do not engage children and women on the battlefield. They are not the enemy. I walked across the street to my house. I was in the process of taking off my jacket because the mission was accomplished.
Billy, who was 43 at the time of the shooting, had been in the Army. It had been more than 20 years since he was on active duty. His service stopped when he fell 10 to 12 feet off of an Army vehicle while stationed in Japan. He suffered a serious skull fracture and developed meningitis while hospitalized for the injury. He also told police that he is bipolar, has PTSD, and took multiple psychiatric medications. Billy's mental state was not discussed initially at the trial. Reports about post-traumatic stress syndrome were not introduced. Instead, his attorney argued that the shooting was self-defense, prompted by an ongoing aggravated stalking and threats to burn down his house and kill him.
The trigger that caused him to act, and that trigger was, come on, let's go, let's end this. Those chilling words caused him to snap.
In legal terms, an argument of self-defense is different than the stand your ground law. The main difference is that if stand your ground can be applied to a situation, you're not required to retreat from any perceived threat. Billy's attorney tried to have stand your ground applied to the case. 3 years before his criminal trial, in 2015, the state held a hearing over whether the case met the standards to fall under that law. Billy took the stand at the hearing and testified for hours. He went through the surveillance footage minute by minute, narrating the video with his rationale during each moment. When he saw the flames outside of his window that night, he said he feared the group was about to make good on its threats to burn his house down, perhaps with a Molotov cocktail thrown through his window. When he army crawled across the street that evening, shortly after he saw the fire, he said he was conducting a surveillance on the group of people and didn't intend to walk across the street to kill them.
So why didn't she just walk over there and kill them all? Well, because you just don't do things like that, sir.
As he crouched in the shadows, he said he listened to their conversation. He heard them discussing a plan to entice him over to their yard to fight him. He thought they wanted to lure him over with a fist fight, but then use a gun on him and kill him. If Billy was on their property, he thought they would be able to argue self-defense for a shooting. Minutes later, he said he heard what he thought was a call to arms.
That's the specific conversation I was tuned into. About them inspired to shoot me after a fist fight here. Gather weapons. Come on, let's do it. Let's go do this. Let's end this. It's a gathering of forces that calls me to snap into action and do what I do.
Much like in his first statement to police, Billy's testimony used terms lifted from military missions. In his hearing, he said that he shot the men multiple times to make sure they were dead. To make sure, he said, that they wouldn't shoot him as he retreated back to his home, comparing his neighborhood feud to wars. After the 3 days of testimony in the Stand Your Ground hearing, Judge James Earp had a verdict. He said Stand Your Ground laws were meant to protect people facing imminent death. That did not apply to Billy Woodward. Quote, "This defendant did not exercise self-defense. This defendant did not stand his ground. What he did was decide to preemptively strike at his victims at a moment when it was entirely unnecessary to do so, and when they were entirely unaware of his presence." Billy Woodward would face capital murder charges. The criminal case against Billy Woodward went to court in January 2018, almost 5.5 years after the night when Roger Pecor and Gary Hembree died and Tim Blake was shot. In his opening statement, prosecutor William Respes warned the jury that they were going to hear the lurid details of what the victims and their families said to Billy, but he cautioned them that they weren't there to decide whether the victims said horrible things or made threats. They had to decide if Billy actually had acted in self-defense or if he was acting as an aggressor when he shot them.
Really, the behavior is bad. It's inexcusable what they were saying to the Woodwards, some of which you'll hear on the tape. And the reasons that he's doing these things is because of his belief that the Titusville Police Department won't solve his problems. And Judge Moxley, a judge, would have solved his problems. And to some extent, he appears to accuse our office of not solving his problems. And so Mr. Woodward was going to solve his own problems. And that's what he did here.
Billy's attorney, Greg Eisenmenger, presented a different view. He argued that his client was responding to an imminent threat after weeks of aggravated stalking. He zeroed in on the moments before the shooting when Billy heard the group of people yell, "Come on, let's do this, let's end this." This shout was a call to gather weapons and launch a fight against him, and he defended himself accordingly, he said.
In many respects, this trial is not going to be so much about what was done, but why it was done, and whether or not it's justified.
Many of the people at the party that night testified at the trial. Questions focused on whether there were weapons present, why they lit a palm branch on fire in the street, and if there were any plans to storm the Woodward house or attack the family. Up first was Justin Pecor, who was 17 years old at the time. Justin was only a few feet away when Billy shot his father, Roger. In his testimony, Justin described seeing Billy come out of the shadows and shoot his father. Later, he hid behind a car when Billy returned to shoot his father again. Justin said he jumped up with his hands up and asked Billy not to shoot him, and then hid inside the house as he heard more gunshots. Tim Blake, who was shot 11 times that night, also testified. But before he described the shooting that nearly ended his life, he answered questions about the taunting and threats that started the problems. More than 5 years had passed since that night. Many of the details had faded in Tim's memory.
Was this a one-way thing, or was it back?
No, it was back and forth. It was just much longer was the other.
But, he said, the group didn't spend the entire evening of September 2nd focused on the Woodwards.
And there were some things said, but it was a...
Well, are you not saying it now? Because you sure said it to the state during the rep.
I just got 10 minutes. There was things said, but the whole night was not devoted to y'all and yelling over there, Billy.
Billy's attorney asked Tim about his version of the Charlie Daniels song caught on video.
And singing out a modified version of Simple Man. Singing out, I'd take a big tall tree and a short piece of rope and hang him high and let him swing until the sun goes down. Eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth. You better watch where you go and remember where you've been. The way I see it, I'm a simple man. In my house, I got a 12-gauge shotgun waiting on the other side. I have to fight. Fight! Put him on their knees and tie him to a stump. Blow him the fuck away. Shot. Eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. You better remember, you better watch where you go and remember where you've been. That's the way I see it. I'm a simple man. You there when that was being?
Probably was.
Okay. You recall who was doing that?
Probably was me.
The defense worked to establish that the problems on Smith Drive started with the victims. Several Titusville police officers who had responded to arguments during August of 2012 testified about responding to 911 calls and trying to get the neighbors to calm down. Each officer was asked if they reviewed the security footage of the threats. None of them did. The solution they offered Billy Woodward was simple. Go inside. Stay away. Other events of the evening were also questioned. Did the lighting of the palm branch and the flare shown on the Woodward surveillance video give Billy reason to believe that the group was planning to ignite his home as they had threatened? Was a shotgun fired that night from Gary's house, or was that banging something else, like a firecracker? Was the group gathering weapons just before the shooting started? Photos of the crime scene focused on a metal bat, which Billy said was part of the group's gathering of weapons just before he started his attack. He said it had been in Roger's hands as he shot him. But Justin testified that although he did hear the clink on the ground of something in the surveillance video after the shooting began, he didn't remember his father holding a bat. Prosecutors pointed out that Billy's own words disputed his claims. In his first statement to police, minutes after the shooting, he acknowledged that the victims were unarmed, despite his later statements that he believed Gary had a shotgun on him that night and Roger was holding the bat. As the prosecution wrapped up the trial, they focused on that simple fact. Billy wasn't defending his family at his home. He had snuck across the street onto his neighbor's property.
At 12:37 a.m., September 3rd, 2012, there is absolutely zero legal justification for the actions, for the decisions that Mr. Woodward made on this preemptive strike. He does not have a green light to murder the Hembrys whenever he wants because of the events on August 11th.
The defense argued that the group of neighbors had been in the commission of a felony that night and for a month beforehand. Florida law considers aggravated stalking as aggressive actions that are solely meant to make others fear for their lives. The neighbors' taunts, threats, the fire, and the noises that night may have been to scare Billy. Were they an imminent threat? Was that threat urgent and serious enough for Billy to take the actions he did?
It wasn't a question of if anymore. It was a question of when.
The jury's verdict came back after one day of deliberation. They convicted Billy Woodward of second-degree murder for the deaths of Roger Pecor and Gary Hembree, and attempted second-degree murder for the shooting of Tim Blake. During his statement to police, Billy told them that his neighbor's taunts forced him inside and that he became a prisoner in his own home. Instead, Billy Woodward is now a prisoner of the state. Billy's sentencing took place 3 months after he had been found guilty. Now, his mental state became an issue his defense wanted to examine. Forensic psychologist Dr. Eric Mings had evaluated whether Billy was competent to stand trial. He testified that Billy has a clearly documented history of post-traumatic stress disorder from his military service. He also has a traumatic brain injury from the skull fracture he incurred in the military. The brain injury also created a secondary problem, a mood disorder, that caused him to have problems with impulse control and anger.
I believe, looking at the records, that most of this originated from a combination of the brain injury when he was 19 years old and then the PTSD as a result of being in combat situations while in the service. He describes in the notes his feelings of anxiety, panic, anger, and similar kinds of experiences that are consistent with what apparently happened here.
Dr. Ming said that given all of Billy's issues, he may have had trouble conforming with what society expected of him. Even so, he said Billy did understand the consequences of his actions. After evaluating notes from Billy's psychiatrist, he saw that Billy discussed the problems with his neighbors in the weeks leading up to the shooting. He understood what could happen if he did what he did.
You would agree that at least he understood the consequences.
Oh, yes, I have no doubt.
And had reflected on that at least as of August 16th.
Yes.
And this happened in September.
Correct. I agree with you.
Those consequences weren't just the criminal charges Billy faced and prison time. They were families and lives forever changed. On both sides of the issue, tearful witnesses described the heartbreaking aftermath of the neighborhood dispute.
He was the best father that I've ever met in my life. And they called him the daddy daycare. And I worked and he stayed at the house with the kids and all that. And take somebody's life like that and destroy these children's lives.
In a letter sent to the judge, Gary Hembree's daughter described how, after his death, her mother has been in and out of jail. She has been shuffled in and out of foster homes and has been riddled with anxiety and depression. She lost more than just her father. She lost her innocence and peace. Billy's family and friends also testified to his gentle and caring nature and the turmoil he endured in the month before the shooting.
Your Honor, please take into consideration our son's past history. He has never, never been in trouble as a child or as an adult. He has always lived an honest life and provided a loving home for his family. We will never lose hope. And I will continue to pray that my son's voice and rights will be upheld, and he will one day be able to return to his family.
The entire case, the dispute, started with just a missing gift. It ended with Billy Woodward sentenced to life in prison. The children he said he fought to protect will grow up with their father in prison. The children of his neighbors, Gary Hembree and Roger Pecor, however, have a much bigger void. They will grow up without ever seeing or speaking to their fathers again. And that's all for today's episode. As always, I want to know what you think about this case. Do you think Billy was justified and feared for his life? Or do you agree with the verdict? What are your thoughts on the sentencing? And what would you have done if you were in Billy's situation? Let me know by joining the conversation on Instagram at Court Junkie, by tweeting me at Court Junkie Pod, or by emailing me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. This episode was researched and written by Sarah Yonker. As always, if you'd like to hear these episodes without the ads, or if you want to find out more about how you can hear additional Court Junkie bonus episodes, go to courtjunkie.com/support, and that will redirect you to my Patreon page. That's courtjunkie.com/support. And finally, this last month, I had the awesome experience of filming with 2020 for an episode they released last week on May 15th. The episode was called Down Payment on Death and was about the Dahlia DiPolito case, which I covered in episode 30. The episodes are all up on 2020's YouTube channel, so definitely check that out. I'll also include a link in the show notes. But it was definitely a cool experience, and I've been loving hearing from all of you who saw it. Thanks again for listening. Until next time. As promised, here is a clip from Copycat Killers.
August 11th, 2014. Two men are on the run from murder, creating an international manhunt.
They're part of a secret organization called Bike Club. It's a group of men who gather together to get what feels like a new lease on life by beating the hell out of each other.
In the movie Fight Club, Brad Pitt and Edward Norton's characters discover fighting is the only way to finally feel free.
There was a rush of adrenaline from fighting, and they want others to experience that freedom, which is why they start their underground club, Fight Club.
Tony Bagnato and Diego Carbone's real-life Fight Club brings them more than they could ever imagine. But what starts out as a way to achieve a boxing career soon turns into a powerful and dangerous business.
Being a successful drug dealer would give him a feeling of power, and that's what he wanted. He wanted power. He wanted control. He really wanted to be on top of the heap.
When a fellow Fight Club member threatens to destroy it all, Tony and Diego find a way to get even.
They want to teach him a lesson. Nobody messes with them. But their plans are flawed, and soon the whole thing goes awry.
Then the body count grows.
Just when you think that these guys are caught and the police are ready to haul them in, you're wrong.
A copycat killer with a real-life Fight Club.
What was the first rule of Fight Club? Don't talk about Fight Club. But everyone wants to talk about Fight Club, both in the movie and real life. Talking about Fight Club is the beginning of the end.